Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for May 8th. Up first is Adam Szivo, writing on why Canada's harm reduction regime is collapsing as disillusionment grows around decriminalized drugs.
Up until as recently as a year ago, harm reduction ideology, which pushes for safer supply of opioids and the decriminalization of hard drugs, enjoyed a near total stranglehold on Canadian addiction policy. But then, in a relatively short period of time, it has fallen out of favor as our politicians, responding to an increasingly fearful public, finally pivoted towards the rhetoric of treatment, recovery, and public safety. Nothing epitomizes this better than BC's NDP government's decision to recriminalize open drug use in public spaces and the Trudeau government's acceptance of that major reversal yesterday. While this shift may have been abrupt and surprising to some, it was also inevitable. The grievous failures of the harm reduction movement could not be concealed indefinitely. When a system is truly broken, a new vision eventually emerges, often despite Herculean efforts to maintain the status quo. This is especially true when the stakes are high, as is the case with the national opioid overdose crisis, which has killed more than 42,000 Canadians since 2016. It should be noted that harm reduction is not inherently a bad thing. Its core idea makes some logical sense. There are some people who are not ready to quit using drugs, so we must mitigate the negative personal and social consequences associated with their ongoing use without necessarily expecting abstinence. This underlying reasonableness is why harm reduction is seen as a critical component of the long popular Four Pillars drug strategy, which pairs it alongside treatment, law enforcement, and drug education. These pillars, when balanced correctly, have a proven track record of meeting the needs of drug users and their surrounding communities in a fair and comprehensive way. Like most general principles, harm reduction also represents a broad umbrella of interventions and strategies, some of which are more helpful and evidence-based than others. Canada's problem hasn't been that harm reduction exists, but rather that, over the past two decades, activists and ideologically motivated researchers have championed particularly radical forms of it. These approaches have been poorly designed, ineptly implemented, and shoddily researched. Worse yet, the other three pillars have been almost entirely abandoned. Canadians are finally noticing this, which is why we are witnessing the current shift towards a more balanced, recovery-oriented paradigm. Nowhere has the failure of the harm reduction movement been more glaring than with overdose prevention sites, safer supply, and drug decriminalization. All three of these interventions have the potential to save Canadian lives if executed correctly, which is perhaps why public support for them was initially so high. Yet too often, Canada has championed models of care that have been shockingly irresponsible, much to everyone's disillusionment. Overdose prevention sites, which provide drug users with a supervised space to use their own substances in relative safety, can be quite useful if they are managed by addiction physicians, staffed by medical professionals, and if they provide clear pathways to recovery. Concurrently, these sites are only sustainable if they manage the crime that inevitably arises from concentrating addicts into one neighborhood. But in Canada, many of these sites are predominantly staffed by active drug users rather than healthcare professionals. Meanwhile, access to recovery-oriented addiction treatments is limited. More often than not, key medications like methadone and Suboxone must be sought elsewhere. While these sites are sold as meeting people where they're at, in reality they are effectively abandoned there. This has often led to chaos and misery. For example, one site in Toronto's Riverdale neighborhood is facing serious allegations that staff permitted rampant criminality and drug trafficking in and around their premises. One harm reduction worker was even charged with being an accessory to murder. Similarly, in Vancouver's Yaletown district, another overdose prevention site was shuttered after the city determined it was grossly mismanaged and had failed to adequately maintain public order. The same dynamic played out with Safer Supply, a strategy that prescribes free pharmaceutical alternatives as alternatives to potentially tainted illicit substances. Many people initially supported Safer Supply, which was understandable. In theory, it can be a useful intervention. assuming, of course, that the provision of free drugs is carefully supervised and that clinicians make a serious effort to transition people into recovery. However, over the past year, the public has discovered that theory and reality are two very different things. In truth, huge amounts of dangerous opioids are being distributed with minimal oversight and only a cursory emphasis on recovery. As a result, most of these drugs are being resold on the black market so that clients can buy even stronger street substances. This has only served to exacerbate the national addiction crisis. Public health officials, along with their government allies, tried very hard to hide this. They consistently produced shoddy research papers that misrepresented the impacts of safer supply. They cherry-picked data. They bullied frontline addiction medicine practitioners into silence. They gaslit and ignored distinguished experts who raised legitimate concerns. But the public eventually came to understand the truth here, too. As mentioned, we have now witnessed the catastrophic failure of BC's drug decriminalization experiment, which permitted the open use and possession of small amounts of drugs like meth, cocaine, and heroin throughout the province via a 3-year pilot program. Advocates promised this reform would mitigate overdoses and deaths. They assured us that destigmatizing addiction would actually encourage drug users to seek recovery-oriented treatment. It was repeatedly emphasized that decriminalization worked for Portugal in the 2000s and that it was only natural to follow Europe's example. But these benefits never materialized. Instead, public disorder exploded and a sense of lawlessness set in. Needles appeared in parks and playgrounds. Addicts were allowed to openly smoke meth and fentanyl in hospital rooms, even if this endangered nurses and other patients. Overdoses and deaths failed to subside. The chaos of decriminalization was so obvious and widespread that the BCNDP was forced to reverse course after less than a year, only to be stymied by a questionable court injunction. And amid this debacle, Canadians belatedly learned that the lauded Portuguese model of drug decriminalization had been misrepresented. Portugal had, in fact, invested significantly into recovery and had never allowed drug users to do whatever they wanted. In fact, the Portuguese model emphasized accountability and coercing addicts into treatment, elements that were missing from BC's comparatively reckless approach. The Canadian public has eyes. And people talk. Over the past year, the failures of harm reduction radicalism have become too visible to ignore. Many Canadians have run out of patience and now feel that their trust was betrayed. While there has been a shift in how the media is now covering addiction and public safety, which has certainly influenced public discourse, this would not have been possible had underlying material realities not permitted it. I say this as someone who greatly contributed to this shift through my own reporting on the failings of safer supply. My job was made much easier by the fact that clinicians and communities were exasperated and desperate to be heard. When harm reduction experts waged a retaliatory campaign of deceit, they failed to succeed because the truth was, and remains, firmly on my side. So now the country is seeking a new direction, one which remains, for the moment, somewhat ill-defined. Alberta is currently leading the conversation by pioneering a recovery-oriented system of care, which recently received formal buy-in from both Ontario and Saskatchewan. But that model, while promising, has its own shortcomings too. New treatment services are launching too slowly, and the system currently lacks mechanisms to coerce addicts into rehab. So is it any surprise that overdoses and deaths remain stubbornly high? Meanwhile, the BCNDP is distancing itself from its old policies and openly discussing recovery and public safety. But their sincerity remains suspect, given it's an election year and, according to polling data, support for the provincial government is collapsing. Whatever the future holds, one thing is clear. The hegemony of harm reduction is ending. The Overton window has shifted, and we are entering a period of new ideas to solve a horrendous national problem.
That was a commentary by Adam Zivo. He is the director of the Canadian Centre for Responsible Drug Policy. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Keldon Formosa, writing on how the consultant class came for Fort Calgary.
The Fort Calgary Preservation Society announced last week that it was no longer time to preserve Fort Calgary. It was, instead, time for the reconstructed Northwest Mounted Police Barracks, which today serves as a museum, cultural site, and gathering place, to rebrand, refresh, renew, and reposition itself for changing times. Guided by marketing consultants, the Preservation Society's leaders decided that after 148 years as Fort Calgary, the National Historic Site should shed its historic name in favor of a new, more modern one. The confluence, referring to the junction of the Bow and Elbow Rivers, the name fits in well with the surrounding condos of the downtown core. The Hat, the Guardian, and the Concord are now joined by another site defined as modern by the Definite article. But just as there are many similarly named condos, there are many river confluences around the world, including at least three more within the city of Calgary. The confluence lacks a sense of place. Which confluence did you get married at again? Was it the Thompson and the Fraser? The Ottawa and the St. Lawrence? Fish Creek and the Bow? The name Fort Calgary was unique. It was about this place, not just any place. Losing that name feels like losing part of what makes our city itself. Now, in fairness to the Preservation Society, Fort Calgary has been renamed before. 1 year after was established in 1875 as Fort Brisebois by Captain Ephraim Brisebois of the Northwest Mounted Police. A dashing and daring character whose misbehavior in the fort's first winter earned him the ire of both his men and his superiors, his superintendent James McLeod renamed it Fort Calgary, after a scenic village on the Scottish coast. The Preservation Society is not wrong, either, that the confluence of the Bow and Elbow Rivers is noteworthy. In semi-arid southern Alberta, river valleys are a source of life and a corridor for the movement of people, goods, and culture. It's no wonder why the meeting place of these two rivers was important to the indigenous people of the western prairies, including the Siksika, Stoney Nakoda, and Sioux Tina, all of whom still make their homes nearby today. Indeed, that's why Fort Calgary was established here. Having shut down the illegal and ruinous American whiskey trade out of Fort Whoop Up, the NWMP turned their attention northwards to establish a new headquarters. From Fort Calgary, NWMP officers would for a generation bring Canadian law and order to what is now southern Alberta, helping to negotiate treaties, run out the aforementioned whiskey traders, and support settlement across the prairies. It's a noble past, in many ways, though not without its dark spots. No less than the city that surrounds it, the fort is defined by Canada's long, complex, and often troubled history with the indigenous peoples of this land. Later, the fort was sold to the Grand Trunk Pacific Railway. The buildings were demolished and the land was turned into a transportation and industrial district. But recognizing the role the fort had played in our past, the federal government named it a National Historic Site in 1925. Almost 50 years later, the land was purchased for protection by the City of Calgary, which delegated the operation of the city-owned site and museum to the Fort Calgary Preservation Society. Since then, two generations of Calgarian schoolchildren have visited to look back on the lives of the people who started our city. In justifying the renaming, the Preservation Society's president, Jennifer Thompson, argued that it was a way of owning the past and present colonial harms of Fort Calgary. She cited the site's newly chosen Blackfoot name meaning harmonious meeting place, written in very small text below the confluence in the new logo, as an example of how this rebranding was about reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. One wonders, however, if the money and sweat equity poured into this rebranding could have been better spent supporting the many homeless and drug-addicted people, a disproportionate number of whom are Indigenous, who spend their days just meters west of the fort near the Calgary drop-in center. I wonder how many of them feel more represented by the confluence than they did by the old fort. Judging by the graffiti nearby, it seems at least some of them sympathize with the NWMP's early mission of casting out the dealers of addiction and death from the prairies. Practically speaking, the grounds of the fort are often strewn with litter and debris, and there are dozens of hard-to-employ people at its doorstep. Could the tens of thousands of dollars spent on a corporate rebranding have been spent on paying some of them a good wage to do some good in their neighborhood? It's also unclear whether erasing Fort Calgary's name actually makes more space for Indigenous people to tell their own stories. While some were involved in the rebrand, others' reactions were mixed. In an interview on Friday, Cheryl Ann Carr-Skadden, general manager of the Indigenous Gathering Place Society, said she was caught by surprise by the renaming and found it a bit perplexing. She went on to describe elders and members of her community asking, "Is that an erasure of history? Is a renaming marketing to say that history doesn't exist? These are fair questions." Even in that specific location, it seems we could find plenty of space to share different perspectives on history. For example, just a few hundred meters south of Fort Calgary, you will find NMAX Park, named after the utility company owned by the city government. This park houses the Elbow River Camp, an indigenous site and cultural display held for the last 100 years during the stampede. I dare say that we do not need a park named after a municipal utility corporation. Calgarians get enough reminders of NMAX on our bank and credit card statements. So why not return that park space to Indigenous people, enabling them to rename it and create a permanent cultural center on the site? Another possibility. There is a large and empty field of grass just east of Fort Calgary, only filled once or twice per year for special events. Why not return that space, leaving Fort Calgary as it is? Those are just two suggestions, and of course we should be guided by Indigenous people in deciding where they would like to tell their stories. But either site would offer Indigenous people the chance to tell their own stories, rather than having their stories told for them by the Preservation Society. We don't need to erase a part of our shared history to accomplish this worthy goal. Ultimately, the Fort Calgary renaming is not about reconciliation properly understood. It's about erasing part of our history that too many would prefer not to think about honestly. It's corporate rebranding driven by marketing consultants and not the collective decision of a democratic community. Indeed, when I asked Ms. Thompson if the Preservation Society ever asked the public about this name change, she said no, they were never directly asked. This is despite the fact that Fort Calgary is a National Historic Site on land owned by the municipal government, and despite the fact that the Preservation Society earns its money mostly through taxpayer subsidies and by renting out those city-owned buildings. One wonders if the decision not to ask the public was a deliberate one. After all, Calgary is a relatively conservative city, and it seems likely that voters would not have approved of the change were it not presented as a fait accompli. Last summer, when the local government canceled Canada Day fireworks on the grounds that our country was unworthy of celebration, the city council had to beat a hasty retreat in the face of public backlash. It's conceivable that a similar reaction might have stopped this rebrand in its tracks. This last fact points us to two solutions. First, nobody needs to respect corporate rebrandings of public spaces that lack democratic consent. To me and many others, it will always be Fort Calgary, no matter what the consultants say. Second, leaders in government who oppose the ongoing efforts to rename, tear down, and erase parts of our history have a powerful ally in the common sense of the common people. An incoming federal government could simply impose the requirement that the renaming of any government-funded institution can only take place after a plebiscite held in conjunction with the next municipal election. If the community decides its name no longer reflects the story it wants to tell, then it can say so. But the whole community should make those decisions, not the consultant class. Given the politics of this city, it may be too late to save the name of Fort Calgary, but thoughtful leadership elsewhere can help to end the slow erasure of our history. The name Fort Calgary may no longer be on the signs, but the name of the fort and the role it played in the history of this city, province, and country should not be forgotten. And no matter what the marketing consultants tell us, it will still be all right to call the fort what it's been called for the last 148 years.
That was a commentary by Keldon Formosa. He is an elementary school teacher in Calgary. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.